Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Today we're talking to author and investigative journalist Antonio Yuhas. Her latest Pacific Standard cover story is entitled Death on the Dakota Access. It's an investigation into the deadly business of building oil and gas pipelines. For the first time, Yuhas has compiled detailed fatality rates for those who actually build U.S. oil and gas pipelines. And her findings tell a very disturbing story about worker safety, the lack of industry regulation, and the environmental destruction that has followed the oil and gas boom here in the United States. She goes back to 2016, when oil and gas pipeline construction workers were dying on the job on average more than 3.5 times more often than the average American worker. So, why is that? She writes about the new plan for U.S. global fossil fuel dominance, and she pairs those findings with the current Trump policy that requires expanding and even fast-tracking new drilling and pipeline construction, and at the same time, decreasing regulation and oversight. Yuhas is predicting that at this rate, the United States is destined to increase the number of these workers on oil and gas pipeline construction who are either injured or who die on the job. So, how is this industry regulated and who takes care of these workers? To look into these issues, we're joined in studio by Antonio Yuhas, and she's a longtime oil and energy investigative journalist. In fact, I don't think anybody knows more about this industry than Antonio. She's author of three books, most recently the title Black Tide, and it deals with the devastating impact of the Gulf oil spill. So good to have you back, Antonio.
Thanks so much for having me, Renee. Great to be with you.
Yes, indeed. And again, you've dedicated your career to looking at the oil and gas industry. And before we get into the most recent research that you've done, you did in Black Tide a look at the Deepwater Horizon back in 2010. That explosion and fire killed 11 people on that platform in the Gulf of Mexico. And you said that you went into a submarine and actually took a look at the environmental damage. And so what did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, so the Deepwater Horizon disaster happened in 2010, or the initial explosion happened in April 2010. And that was and remains the worst offshore drilling explosion in history, the worst offshore drilling oil and gas incident in world history, the largest amount of oil spilled, and it included the death of 11 workers on the rig. And there were many lessons that I learned from that in ongoing investigation. And not only did I write the book Black Tide, but continued to return again and again, reporting for magazines like Rolling Stone and Harper's Magazine and The Nation, to continue to return and see what continues to happen in the Gulf. The impacts on the families of those who lost loved ones and workers who were on the rig at the time of the disaster, and on the environment and on the economies of the Gulf of Mexico. And one of the lessons was that taught by the judge who ruled in the case finally against BP, saying that they unquestionably put profit ahead of all other concerns and were pushing to save time and to save money. And that seems obvious after the fact, but of course, while these operations are underway, we're always told these are the wealthiest companies on the planet. Of course, they're doing everything they can to protect their workers. Of course, they're doing everything they can to protect the environment. And we're told that that's what we should expect. But then when these disasters happen, it's like, we're also then told to just expect, oh, yes, of course they're trying to save money. Of course they're trying to save time. And of course that results in often the death of workers and destruction of the environment. And the Gulf of Mexico, when I was in the sub that you had mentioned, I was in the Alvin submarine. It's the last research submarine dedicated to research for ocean scientists. And I was with Dr. Samantha Joy, and this was a couple years after the disaster had happened. And we were the first sub that wasn't being run by BP to get closer than anyone had to the site of the blowout at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico to see what was happening down there. And what we learned was that basically everything that could get out of the way of the oil got out of the way of the oil, all the critters. Everything that couldn't was buried under a permanent carpet of oil that now blankets the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. It's a cold, frozen environment, dark, and all of the sort of worst parts of the oil are what are still there. The things that the little bacteria that eat oil didn't want to eat or excrete it out because it's too dangerous and too toxic for them. Mm. And that's still there. And that killed everything that couldn't get out of the way of it. And it is, as some life has come back to the region, which it has, some sea life, though that sea life is then consuming that toxic oil that's still down there. And it's making its way through various food chains, including, for example, things like phytoplankton, which is the basis of 50% of the oxygen we need on this planet to live. And so the reverberations, there's oil that's still being found, for example, in the eggs of birds that have flown through the Gulf of Mexico and had eaten something along the way. There are still entire communities of species that haven't fully recovered. And of course, there's ongoing economic impacts and health impacts on both workers and people who lived near the site of the Gulf of Mexico. BP, on the other hand, just most recently awarded its current CEO, Bob Dudley, this just a couple weeks, actually last week, a award for the Petroleum CEO of the Year. And one of the reasons they cited was his ability to recover the company from the disaster. And the company is economically fully recovered, which is not doesn't sound well, I think, to many of the families and communities that were economically devastated by the disaster.
Well, I bring this up for three reasons, Antonia. First of all, there's actually another spill happening right this minute in New Orleans, and the Washington Post is saying that it has the potential to be even worse than the blowout at the Deepwater Horizon site. It's an oil spill that's been quietly leaking millions into the Gulf and has gone unplugged. So something between 300 and 700 barrels of oil a day are spewing about 12 miles off the coast of Louisiana. So it's happening so quietly that no one's really paying attention. I also bring it up because that Deepwater Horizon thing, Mark Wahlberg and the film that was made about it, means that people paid a bit more attention to it.
That's right.
And might have that in their mind as we go forward and talk about the pipeline construction and the dangers therein. And thirdly, I'm assuming that that research on what happened at the Deepwater Horizon informed your investigation into what happens when people are building these oil and gas pipelines. How many people are actually in danger? So let's start by asking you about the North Dakota Access Pipeline, the NDAP. You started at the linchpin year was like 2016. Why did you decide to look at this pipeline, and why that year?
So this is the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's otherwise known as DAPL, D-A-P-L. And the Dakota Access Pipeline grabbed my attention as it grabbed headlines across the country because it became, I would say, the most contentious modern U.S. oil or gas project ever in the modern era. There are a number of reasons for that. But one is, as you cite, the disaster with Deepwater Horizon, just an increasing attention paid to oil and gas production in the United States as that oil and gas production has ramped up. We've been in a drilling boom that really began around 2005, and we've almost without stop, although there have been a few bumps along the way for the drillers, we have been drilling so much oil and natural gas in the United States that in 2015 we surpassed the record that we had set before in 1970 and then went beyond it. And in 2012, we became the largest oil or natural gas producer in the world of the two resources combined. And this has been because of this consistent boom in production, offshore, onshore, anywhere they can drill. And that led to more and more communities and people being directly impacted by drilling who hadn't been previously, and led to increased opposition to that drilling, and then increased learning from those communities across impacts and across locations, those communities coming together more and more and more to stand up with each other in resistance to operations and to target production and pipelines. So with the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is the largest pipeline ever built out of North Dakota, you saw the coming together of a number of different communities that had been increasingly impacted by oil and gas drilling, and particularly U.S. indigenous communities who had seen their treaty rights, their environments negatively impacted for too long, and had really come together in a very profound way to stop this pipeline. And they were joined by allies from across the world and across the nation supporting them. So 150 different Native American and international tribes came together in opposition to this one pipeline, and that had never happened before. So this was a very historic resistance event. And I came to cover it doing a couple of different investigations for Pacific Standard and for Grist magazines, and didn't intend when I came to cover it to cover death or worker safety. But then in August 2016, I learned of the death of one worker building the Dakota Access Pipeline. And there was a little sort of blip of a report in the local AP covering his death with very limited information.
Can we assume, Antonia, that this surge, this boom, is not because all of a sudden these resources were discovered, but because for political reasons, it was important to drive down dependence on foreign reserves and to drive down prices. And people like having gas prices low, and politicians love to claim that they drove those prices down. So all of a sudden, these reserves were always in the ground. So why did they decide to start building these pipelines, and why did they become so important for these bottom lines, for the company's bottom line?
Yeah, it isn't associated with a decline in price. So that's really important. Actually, as the surge in production was getting underway, the price of oil was also increasing dramatically. And the price of oil got to its highest modern point in 2008. And the reason why it came down was because the price of oil helped precipitate the global financial collapse. The price of oil became $150 a barrel. It was way too much for economies that are dependent on oil to purchase, and consumers who are dependent on gasoline to be able to withstand. That, together with the deregulation in the housing sector and investment in the housing sector, helped contribute to the global financial collapse. The global financial collapse, more than anything else, contributed to the collapse of the price in oil, not increased production. And certainly increased production is not on tangent with a reduction in the price of gasoline for American consumers. A lot of what happened was we were increasing that production and we were shipping a great deal of it to Canada. So while there was a blockade for a good amount of time, although it doesn't exist any longer, on exporting oil out of the United States, there was an exception for exporting that oil to Canada. So we were shipping a lot of it to Canada. And there wasn't a prohibition on shipping gasoline, which we were also increasingly exporting out of the United States during that period as well. So the reason for the increase in production really had to do, it began under the Bush administration, and it was a combination of the Bush administration relaxing regulations on where companies could drill and under what conditions they could drill, a combination of that and new technology making fracking easier and more affordable for companies.
And fracking Fracking extracts natural gas from the earth.
It's also oil. So fracking is just a technique by which you blast using a giant water and chemical cannon. You go underground, you blast using this cannon, you blast rock in which oil is found. So whereas traditionally most oil is found in what is not exactly but kind of equivalent to sort of an underground reservoir of oil, and you sort of tap a pipe into it, and I'm making this much more simple than it actually is, and that oil comes out fairly simply. Oil or natural gas that is trapped within rock formations under the ground has to be released from those rock formations. And fracking is a way of hydraulic fracturing of the rock.
So hydraulic means water. So you're blasting it with water.
Water and chemicals.
Okay.
A water and chemical cocktail. Okay. And that technology, combined with the deregulation of the Bush administration, as well as the desire of the Bush administration to really help oil and gas companies make more money, is what led to the beginning of the boom. And that boom was then carried on from administration to administration to administration.
It's always so helpful to get Oil and Gas 101 from you, Antonia, because, you know, we tend to, once again, just go to the pump or turn on the pilot light and just assume that it's going to be there. But there are consequences, environmental and in terms of worker health and safety.
That's right.
If you're just joining us, Antonia Juhas is here, and we're talking today about her most recent research into literally the human cost of the oil and gas industry. So in May of 2016, the construction on the pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, began. It's about 1,200 miles long. How unusual is this particular construction project?
So this is the largest pipeline ever to be built out of North Dakota. We have seen a boom in oil and gas pipeline construction that coincided with the oil and gas production boom, and a rapid increase in pipeline construction. So rapid, in fact, and again, this is similar to where we started with BP Deepwater Horizon disaster, where again, I said that the judge's final ruling in the case was very clear that BP had put saving time and money over safety. You wanted to say
something?
Yeah,
I think
his
exact words were BP was guilty of gross negligence and willful misconduct. And but there was no real consequence, so...
I mean, there was the largest judgment against any oil company ever for environmental abuse in the case of BP. It was, I don't have these numbers memorized in my head anymore right now, but around a $60 billion judgment. But it gives you a sense of how big these companies are, that was a drop in the bucket for BP. So BP is perfectly financially healthy today after facing what was the largest environmental judgment by any U.S. court against an oil company.
So no lessons learned in terms of the consequences of companies who are doing the construction on these pipelines. They figure they just kind of bake that into their financial cake.
Well, I mean, I think that there were many lessons learned, and the Obama administration, for example, started putting in place new regulations on offshore drilling, which the Trump administration eliminated. The Obama administration started putting in place new regulations for Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, which oversees worker safety onshore and some offshore, began putting in place energy regulations and environmental regulations, 1,500 of which the Trump administration has removed, 300 just in the energy sector alone. So there were a lot of lessons learned, and they've been unlearned under the new administration. Not to say that the Obama administration did anything close to everything that could and should have been done, but it learned a lot, studied a lot, and put in place many good reforms. I would say almost all of which have been eviscerated under this administration. But what is very similar for the pipeline companies is this speed, the necessity for speed and saving time and saving money at the expense of worker, environmental, and community health and safety. So since 2010, oil and natural gas pipelines and pipelines carrying all hazardous materials, of which oil is a part, are significantly more likely to fail than pipelines built at any time in the last century. So in other words, the newer the pipeline in the United States, the more dangerous it is, the more likely it is to explode, to rupture, to have an incident during its construction or once it's done that puts someone in the hospital, either a community member or a worker. And that's because of the lack of appropriate regulations, lack of appropriate oversight, and the companies just moving for speed and saving money without being held to appropriate regulatory account. And that is what happened with the Dakota Access Pipeline, which, where we started this discussion, you know, this was an extremely unique pipeline for many reasons, but also not that unique. Oil pipelines are getting built across the United States, but this was the one that got attention, which is why I was there in the first place, which is why I happened to notice when Troy Dolan died while the pipeline was being constructed, which is then what led me to investigate and open an entirely, unfortunately, entirely new area of investigation looking into the fatalities of oil and gas pipeline construction workers. Because though the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes fatality rate data for almost all industries, that's where we get fatality rate data for industries in the United States, they have only occasionally done so for oil and gas production, and they have never, ever done so for oil and gas pipeline construction. So I did that work myself.
It's extraordinary. You would think it would almost seem to follow that lessons would have been learned and that the dangers would be lessened, not increased, going forward. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Antonia Yuhas and her about her latest Pacific Standard cover story. It's called Death on the Dakota Access. This is the pipeline that hit all of the headlines, where Native American tribes attempted to stop the construction on this 1,200-mile pipeline unsuccessfully as recently as last week, when construction workers were forced to stop by activists who were trying to kayak up to the work sites and dangle from trees and make platforms to just stop the clear cutting for this thing. But it appears to be to no avail. Or is there any help for the workers who are actually facing dangerous circumstances? 866-798-8255 is the number if you have questions for Antonia. So again, this describe this pipeline. It carries about more than 500,000 barrels of oil a day, but it originates where and it goes where and it ends up where?
Sure. So this is a series of pipelines that begins in North Dakota, and it starts in the upper tip of the of North Dakota, traveling across most of the state. It originates near Stanley, North Dakota, travels across the state, then cuts into South Dakota, then Iowa, then Illinois. And that pipeline is called the Dakota Access Pipeline. It then connects in Illinois with another pipeline called Energy Transfer Crude Oil Pipeline, or ETCO, which then carries that oil to Texas. From Texas, that pipeline is now, there's one leg that's still being built, and that's what you were just referencing. Mm-hmm. And that's the Bayou Bridge Pipeline. So what the Bayou Bridge Pipeline does is where the Dakota Access Pipeline combined with ETCO, which is combined called the Bakken Pipeline, carries that oil from North Dakota to Texas. The reason for carrying that oil from North Dakota to Texas is to export it. That's the reason why.
Where's it going?
It's going wherever the companies wish to send it. Mm-hmm. It's also being refined there into gasoline and other products, but increasingly into petrochemical products. It has to be what's called both the oil, but even more so natural gas, are cracked into components that are then become the inputs into plastics and making plastics. So a lot of this is about increasing the plastics market. But back to this pipeline. So this pipeline goes to Texas, and to export, this is oil, primarily to export it out of the United States. Then the Bayou Bridge Pipeline, which you just referenced, is just this extra leg that cuts across this beautiful bayou system in Louisiana to the Louisiana coast to essentially allow the Louisiana markets to cash in as well, so that that same oil will feed refineries in Louisiana and, again, to be exported. And, again, part of this As I discussed this boom in oil and natural gas production, there's a strong attempt to get all of that product to the coasts so that it can be exported out of the country. But one of the things that the industry is particularly interested in right now is dramatically increasing that production for petrochemicals for making plastics, because they see us looking at reducing the amount of oil and natural gas that is used for energy, reducing the amount of oil and, or electricity, reducing the amount of oil and natural gas that is used for transportation.
Because of conservation measures.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so they are looking to dramatically expand petrochemical production. And part of this movement of this oil out of North Dakota, but also natural gas across the country to get it to the coast via pipeline is to help feed this booming petrochemical industry, in addition to just transporting out the oil and gasoline and natural gas as LNG.
We are talking oil and gas construction. What do these pipelines look like, and what is the cost in human life to construct these pipelines that bring us the petrochemicals, oil, and gas that we've come to rely on? We're going to hear the names Nicholas Janicich and Troy Dolan, two workers who lost their lives in the construction of these pipelines. 866-798-8255 is the number. Stay with us. We'll be right back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call. As Kevin said, we are podcasting the show, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Tomorrow, philanthropists talk about changing the world for the better, but very often they use market-based win-win sort of solutions, sort of the capitalist's idea of philanthropy. In his new book, Winners Take All, former insider Anand Giriharadas exposes the irony of so-called change agents who end up pushing solutions that leave the systems that allowed them to get rich in the first place untouched. He says that elites favor ways of thinking that focus on the unnamed and unaccountable systems that often leave out the greater part of our population. So join the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. If you're just joining us on today's One Planet series, we're talking with investigative reporter Antonia Juhas about her latest cover story. It's called Death on the Dakota Access. 866-798-8255 is the number. So your latest investigation took you to North Dakota. You looked into two deaths at the Dakota Access Pipeline, and you uncovered the fact that the oil and gas boom that you referred to has actually turned the pipeline construction industry into one of the deadliest in the country. So how did you decide to focus on the danger to the workers and focus on that specifically?
Yeah, and I'd also written on the pipeline itself and resistance to the pipeline. And then when I found out, I saw this AP report that there had been a worker who had died building the pipeline, and it received very little press attention. So I started to dig into what the circumstances were. And the first thing I found out was that there was very little information about the circumstances of his death.
Now, is this Troy Dolan or Nicholas Janicich?
This is Nicholas Janicich.
Okay.
And so I began to dig deeper into his death, filing a Freedom of Information Act request, going out near to where his death occurred, getting information from the unions of which he was a member, and began to sort of piece together the dangers associated with building pipelines. And it made me decide that I wanted to focus just on this question, do an investigation into this question of why, how he died, and how his death is emblematic of the dangers of this industry and how it has been unreported previously. So the first is just looking at Nicholas Janicich. So he's 27 years old. He was from Grand Rapids, Minnesota. And he had only been, this was the first pipeline he had ever worked on, and he'd only been on the job for 3 weeks. Mm. And he was alone working in a very rural part of North Dakota. The closest town was Tioga, North Dakota, population 1,500 people. This increase of moving workers into more and more rural, out of the way parts of the country is a hallmark of fracking, because oil is, the access is being given to oil in more and more parts of the country through deregulation, but also fracking is opening up areas to production that hadn't previously seen production before. Janicic was working essentially alone, but he was also working on what should be one of the easiest and safest parts of this job. It's the end of the pipeline construction. The pipe has already been laid. The land's been restored on top of it, and he's driving a tractor, basically tilling the land to restore it to its close to its original, the way it was before the pipeline was built. What he was specifically doing was pulling an inline ripper, which is this sort of a giant piece of farm equipment that has these scythe-like blades that cut into the earth. And he was hired by a subcontracting company called Indian Head Pipeline, which was itself a subcontractor to Precision Pipeline, which was itself a subcontractor to Dakota Access LLC, which is itself, and I'm going to go through this chain of companies because this is important. It's part of the reason why the companies are so shielded from deaths being identified with their pipelines or any liability or accountability, because Dakota Access LLC is owned by Energy Transfer Partners LP, which is owned by Energy Transfer Partners Equity LP.
And why is all that important? Just, you know.
And then there's one more company. Let me get there.
Okay.
LEGP LLC, which is the general partner that owns Energy Transfer Equity LP.
Now, and is that to say that there's no accountability somewhere in that chain?
That's right. So basically, the only companies that are held to account are the what's called the immediate employer. So that means that Janicic was hired by Indian Head Pipeline, which is the immediate employer. They were the only company held to account for his death. And almost nowhere would you see the rest of these companies named. And because of that, it was almost impossible for me to find the second death, which had previously not been reported at all as associated with Dakota Access Pipeline, because you can't just, for example, type into the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA's website, Dakota Access Pipeline, and see all the workers who died or were injured building that pipeline. That option doesn't exist to the public. Because I was looking at this point for if there were any other deaths, I found the names of the companies that were the primary subcontracting companies for the workers. I looked for deaths associated with those companies. I then went state by state looking at where those deaths happened, what were the circumstances of the deaths. I then looked at press reports that coincided with the location of the pipeline. And through that process, I identified Dolan's death. And he died 3 days after Nicholas Janicic at the opposite end of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So Janicic died in North Dakota. He was injured when he went to fix on his own a piece of equipment that had been altered by the subcontracting company. He didn't to fix it by himself, which he should have called his foreman to get a company that actually knew how to fix the piece of equipment. But time is money in the oil field, so he tried to do it himself. He put a jack stand into the piece of equipment, and it came crashing onto his skull, likely fracturing his skull. He died within 24 hours of being injured. 3 days later, on the opposite end of the pipeline, Troy Dolan was working, and he was suffering from extreme heat exhaustion. He should have been sent home. Instead, he found a respite under a one-ton truck, the flatbed of a one-ton truck. He must have passed out there, and he was run over when the truck driver moved and crushed him under the weight of the truck. Again, he should have been, there's no question that he should have been sent home based on the interviews of the people who were present at the time. But, you know, time is money, and he was kept on the job, and he also died on the job. Now, this checkerboard of companies means that it's also very difficult to know if there were other deaths that happened. I don't know, under construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's possible that there were, but there isn't enough publicly accessible information to know for certain. I also only know about injuries on the job in only one of the states, because that's because North Dakota is the only state that publicly makes available this worker injury data associated with a particular job site. So I know that there were 11 workers who were injured on the job, but I don't know there's no way to know if there were other injuries in the other states through which it passes.
Do you think that's on purpose?
Oh, for sure. For sure. To make it much more difficult to know deaths and injuries. And that's also been made more difficult under the Trump administration, which has limited and restricted publicly available and reported data on injuries and fatalities of workers. So while I was in the course of writing this article, the information that I needed was in some ways sort of disappearing from these public websites because the data that needed to be made available was being limited, that I needed was being limited by the Trump administration. But what I then found after I identified these two deaths, I then found, as I had mentioned earlier, that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has not been presenting fatality rate data for this industry. So with their guidance and with their help in trying to mimic as close as possible the way that they create fatality rate data, I used publicly available data, Bureau of Labor Statistics data, to create my own fatality rate. And I found that just like oil and gas production, the building of oil and natural gas pipelines is among one of the deadliest jobs in the country.
In fact, you found something like 3.6 times more deadly than the average American worker's job.
That's right. In 2016, this fatality rate reached highs of 7 times the national average twice since 2003, which is when the Bureau of Labor Statistics only began providing the numbers of workers who have died while in this job sector, and that fatality rate of 7 times the average American worker is consistent also for oil and gas production, which is also, it turns out, one of the deadliest jobs in America. So producing the oil and natural gas and building the pipelines to carry it are among the deadliest jobs in the nation.
Were you surprised by that? That it's not just the offshore drilling, which we, you know, picture being out in the middle of the ocean and subject to the elements and all kinds of other dangers. So to what extent were you surprised that the actual pipeline construction itself is so deadly?
Yeah, I think both for the onshore production and the pipelines, I was very surprised at how high these fatality rates were, particularly because, you know, even as someone who spends a lot of my time investigating accidents that go wrong in this industry, we all still live within this, sort of general understanding created by the oil and gas industries that they, because they are so wealthy, because they are so advanced, that they are, you know, spending every available dollar that they can to make their work sites as safe as possible. And of course, that's what Energy Transfer Partners said when we sought input from them in response to the article. And that's not the case. So these are very dangerous work sites is what one finds out. And they are extremely lacking in appropriate regulatory oversight. And in some cases, almost no regulatory oversight at all. And they are extremely dangerous for their workers and extremely dangerous for the communities through which they pass. And to me, that was very, very surprising, even as someone who spends so much time studying what goes wrong. And that these dangers have increased for a number of reasons. One being, well, it might be too much to go into in the time that we have. It's increased for a number of reasons, including because of the Trump administration and an even additional push at deregulation that's happened. But problems existed even before the Trump administration came in. So you were taking what was already a dangerous job and just making it even more dangerous as a result of this new administration. So one of the things that happened, for example, on the Dakota Access Pipeline is that prior to Nicholas Jonasich's death, the OSHA office, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration office in North Dakota, had not visited a single work site along the Dakota Access Pipeline
at all.
The entire 6 months of its construction prior to his death.
Why? They weren't responsible for the oversight, or it was an oversight on their part, or why wouldn't they have visited it? Not once.
So what's odd about oil and natural gas is that even though this is one of the deadliest job sectors in the country, and even though it's considered part of the mining sector by the federal government, it's not regulated in the same ways that the mining sector is. It is under lesser regulatory standards and is considered a quote-unquote low-hazard industry so that it faces lesser regulation than things like coal mining or other types of mining of which it's technically a part. Instead, it's under the OSHA Act, which doesn't require mandatory job site inspections. And OSHA is a tragically underfunded agency. So in the entire state of North Dakota, there are only 8 OSHA inspectors for every single job site in the entire state. So whether that's a grocery store or a factory or an oil pipeline, there's only 8 inspectors.
Well, now I just find that shocking.
I agree.
You were shocked too, but I mean, that just seems impossible.
And that's, so what the AFL-CIO estimated is that it would take 100 years for each job site in North Dakota to be visited just once in 100 years by OSHA. And that's typical across the country. So you have not enough inspectors. You also have areas of oil and gas that, because of oil industry lobbying, are exempt from a number of requirements of oversight and regulation. And then you have, on top of that, the Trump administration coming in and rolling back regulations that had been tried to be put in place by the Obama administration. And you have a budget that, for example, right now for the entire OSHA budget, it's what it was in 2010. And basically since 1970, when OSHA was created, it hasn't been it hasn't seen its budget significantly increased anyway. And then now that budget is under attack by the Trump administration, as well as a hiring freeze and then retirements that happened with a lot of people wanting to leave when the Trump administration came into office, with a decline in investigators, a decline in managers across the board, across the country.
Well, both the workers that you profiled, Janicich and Dolan, were represented. They were members of the LIUNA, which represents many of the nation's pipeline workers, including about 1,100 of the Dakota Access Pipeline workers. So why is the construction so fatal? And who's looking out for these workers and making sure that they're being taken care of if what you describe is happening? Who's looking out for the workers?
Yeah, you bring up a really important point, which is one of the reasons why these jobs are so dangerous, is how low of union representation they have. So oil and gas production is almost entirely non-unionized. There are almost no unions at all representing oil and gas production workers. The pipelines are somewhat more unionized. Estimates of the amount are hard to come by, maybe 30%. And that's because unions like the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, which you mentioned, these are unions that represent workers in otherwise traditionally more unionized sectors, like construction. These are laborers, mm-hmm. and they are constructing a pipeline. So essentially where oil and gas work overlaps with other sectors, you see some unionization. So, for example, refinery workers are maybe about 50% potentially represented by unions because they overlap with the United Steelworkers unions. The pipeline workers are somewhat represented because they overlap with construction work. On these union job sites, and I researched this, fatalities are about half for oil and gas pipeline construction on union-represented job sites than non-union-represented workers. And so Dakota Access Pipeline, and I didn't have the capacity to look at all pipelines in the U.S., may in fact be unique that there were only 2 deaths because it was a union job site. There were union companies. These workers were represented by unions, and the job sites were union job sites. That said, the unions only have so much influence, obviously, in this day and age, and their influence is quite under attack. So that also means that what they are able to push for each day is limited because they have so many obstacles that they're trying to overcome and less influence, obviously, than they have had in the past.
Okay, let's go to a question. Greg in Palo Alto, thanks so much for waiting.
Well, thank you. I hope I don't get you off your subject here, but I wanted to ask you a couple questions. One, clearly the companies don't have any regard for their employees' health and safety. That's not true just for this pipeline, but I'm sure Ms. Juhas knows about the Deepwater Horizon and things that happened in Richmond where people were killed at refineries or died at refinery explosions and fires. I guess what I'm concerned about, though, is that beyond the individuals involved, and it's the loss of life is tragic. But what this has for broader implications, you know, under the economic system that we live in, you know, capitalism, and the sense of urgency with regard to not only this issue, but the impact that these companies are going to have once they complete this, if they are able to complete this, on the climate, and what that's going to mean in terms of, and I'm not trying to make the deaths of these people insignificant, but imagine the deaths that are going to occur as a result of their being able to develop these ridiculous tar sands, etc. So I saw 700,000 people at an anti-Brexit thing in London, and I wonder what she thinks it's going to take for people to get a sense of urgency about this issue, climate change, and really do something about it.
Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. I think that there is a dramatic sense of urgency around climate change, and we need to see the protection of workers whose job it still remains. While we are still using oil and natural gas and while we're still using fossil fuels, there are going to be people whose job it is to get it out of the ground and move it around. And we need to see the fate of their safety as tied into the work that's being done to transition away from fossil fuels. And even these unions have put a lot of energy into thinking about transitioning their workers away from oil and gas jobs because of safety, but also because of the climate and wanting to see jobs in the renewable energy sector. So one of the things that I talk about in the article is what can we do to transition these workers, because the skills needed to build an oil and natural gas pipeline do not change depending on what is moving through that pipeline. And so in the United States, we are facing a crisis for water pipelines. Flint, Michigan is the perfect example. We have dangerous, old, toxic pipelines that are carrying our most valuable resource, which is our water, the resource of which we actually are, our life is actually dependent upon, which is water. It's not dependent on oil or gas. And if we had a massive public investment, which we need, in our water pipelines, making them newer, safer, those same workers who are currently building oil and natural gas pipelines could instead be transitioned into water pipeline construction and rehabilitation. And the call that was put out by those who were resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline was that they are water protectors. They did not call themselves protesters. They called themselves water protectors. They were there to protect the water flowing, that the pipeline was going to flow under, and protecting water resources across the country and across the world. And they called themselves water protectors. And that the pipeline workers could themselves also be water protectors in that sense if we helped them transition into a sector that is safer, because of course the skills are the same regardless of what's moving through the pipeline, but the safety of the pipeline is significantly increased if it's not having an explosive or toxic substance moving through it, but rather water is moving through it. And that's one solution that would also help us protect the workers, but transition away from oil and natural gas and towards a framework that's about protecting water. And in so doing, we would, of course, be helping to adhere to the demands that the International Panel on Climate Change just released last week, a dire warning saying that we only had 13 years to try and keep global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that requires keeping fossil fuels in the ground. And as we embrace that necessity, we also have to think of the people whose jobs it is, who are still doing that work.
Okay, thanks, Greg. Let's go next to Josh in San Francisco. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go right ahead.
Great, thanks. This question's for Antonio. I appreciate all of the coverage you've done. I was out at Standing Rock myself with my partner during the first week of December when the veterans were all there. And we became witnesses for a Lakota woman who's also right next to us. And, you know, my question is, like, is there kind of a detriment to only kind of explaining one side, you know, and side meaning, you know, Trump's agenda as well as, you know, what the actual pipeline workers are doing in conjunction with the lax, you know, legislation in that area? Is there a detriment to future movements in not covering what happens when people within our side tend to do, you know, awful things as well.
And such as what?
Human cost. So the woman that was falsely accused was with basically her family, and she had her 82-year-old elder mother from Pine Ridge with her, and they were separated by a private military contractor working with the veterans group with Wes Clark Jr., and she spent 6 months in jail on elder abuse charges, and they placed her mother in the care of an emergency guardian, and it took us almost a year to get her back. I actually reached out to you, I believe, in June on this issue after you published that piece about Tiger Swan, because
thanks,
you know,
Josh.
A lot of talk about the other side, but there wasn't any talk about our side.
Okay. We've got about 2 minutes left, Antonia. Did you want to respond quickly?
Yeah, I mean,
to
it's a really important issue, and I actually think there was a fair amount of coverage on what was happening within the campsite. And, you know, I appreciate you reaching out to me. I don't remember receiving that, but I appreciate you reaching out to me. And there's only, unfortunately, so much that I can cover. If you want to support independent investigative journalism and make it possible for me to write more stories, I would love that. I am deeply restricted in what I can cover based on the resources available to me and the outlets I'm able to publish in. But in choosing my stories, I was trying to choose issues that I saw as not receiving the same amount of attention and having, you know, just a voice to reach even more people, to make them aware and interested in these topics. Not to say that the issue that you were raising, particularly the issue of families being separated, aren't critically important. So thank you for your call and bringing that to our attention.
Quickly, with just about a minute left, Antonia, what do you think people would or could or should do differently if they understood the dangers of this construction? Just about a minute left.
I think it's really important, as the Trump administration is touting itself as one that is about protecting workers and building jobs, that we look highly critically at what that means and who's actually getting the benefits of the administration, and that we look at the data around the dangers of oil and gas work and incorporate that into our transitioning from a fossil fuel-based economy to one where we keep fossil fuels in the ground.
Outstanding. Antonia Juhas, as usual, always so informative. She's an investigative reporter who reported from Standing Rock for Pacific Standard. She's the author of 3 books. Her latest article for the Pacific Standard cover story is Death on the Dakota Access, an investigation into the deadly business of building oil and gas pipelines. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for the calls. Malihe Razazan produced today's show, and Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. Kevin Vance is the studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. It's your call.